Welcome to the 19th episode of our podcast, Religion in Praxis. Today, we're incredibly honored and privileged to have with us a highly distinguished historian and one of the leading authorities in the field, Professor Serhiy Plukhii. Professor Plukhii holds the esteemed Mikhailo Khrushchevsky Professorship of Ukrainian History at Harvard University and serves as the director of Ukrainian Research Institute, where he has been instrumental in furthering our understanding of Eastern European history. An internationally renowned expert, Professor Plukhii's academic pursuits delve into the intellectual, cultural, and international history of Ukraine, of Ukraine, Eastern Europe, with his research shedding light on the myriad aspects of Ukraine's rich historical tapestry. His scholarly contributions to the field are nothing short of exceptional, as evidenced by his numerous acclaimed publications. Among his many works, Professor Plukhii has penned the groundbreaking book Atoms and Ashes, A Global History of Nuclear Disasters, which offers a comprehensive exploration of nuclear catastrophes throughout history. In addition to his thought-provoking collection of essays, The Frontline, the essays on Ukraine past and present, which illuminates the complexities of Ukrainian historical trajectory. Further testaments to his expertise are his insightful books, Nuclear Folly, A History of Cuban Missile Crisis, Forgotten Bastards of the Eastern Front, American Airmen Behind the Soviet Lines and the Collapse of the Grand Alliance, published by Oxford University Press, Chernobyl, The History of Nuclear Catastrophe, and The Gates of Europe, A History of Ukraine, which became a New York Times bestseller. Professor Plukhii's extensive scholarship has garnered him numerous accolades, including the prestigious Paley Gifford Prize and the Shevchenko National Prize in 2018. His work has been instrumental in shaping our understanding of Eastern Europe in general and its history. We're truly grateful for the opportunity to learn from such an eminent scholar. On a personal note, Professor Plukhii's Lost Kingdom and Gates of Europe inspired me to delve deeper into my own research in Ukraine, of course, very moderate comparison. And I'm very thankful for such an opportunity to discuss your most recent scholarship with us. Join us for an enthralling journey throughout the pages of history as we unravel the complex and intriguing relationships between Russia and Ukraine with renowned Harvard professor and expert, Professor Plukhii. Delighted to host you to our podcast.
First of all, thank you so much for such a generous introduction. It's really a pleasure to be on the podcast, and I look forward to a really, really inspiring discussion.
Many thanks. Today, we will address three themes echoed in your most recent book, The Russian Russo-Ukrainian War, The Return of History. Throughout the history, there has been a constant struggle between Russia's imperial ambitions and Ukraine's national identity. Could you provide an overview of the origins of this struggle and discuss how it has persisted and evolved into the contemporary context?
There is a number of ways how this war and the road to the war, the all-out Russian invasion of Ukraine, was imagined. And one of the narratives was really looking at the prehistory as the history of the NATO expansion and allegedly Russian response to it. By Russian reaction to the admission of Finland and Sweden is about to join NATO as well, one can see that narrative about Ukraine allegedly ready to join NATO was a false one. It was an excuse. The way how I look at the beginning of this war, at the context that brought to it, I look at that as the context, historical context of the disintegration of the empires. So in many ways, the current war is a continuation of the story that started back in 1914, with the start of World War I, and the disintegration of the Russian Empire in 1918-1919. With then being stitched together by the Bolsheviks and falling apart again in 1991. In 1991, we were under impression that we fooled history, one of the largest empires, post-imperial multi-ethnic state, disintegrated without a major war and without major warfare. There were clashes and war, certainly in Georgia, in North Caucasus, in Moldova, in Chechnya, but somehow it was overlooked. We considered that were the bumps to the road of continuing prosperous and peaceful development of the post-Soviet era. Today we know that the major clash, a big clash, was just postponed in time. And just one indication that this imperial framework, the framework of the disintegration of empire, is much more than just a tool that historians like me use to understand this war. One can look at the part of the explanation of the war that comes from Vladimir Putin, who really uses the Russian imperial language, references to Russians and Ukrainians as being one and the same people, which goes all the way back to the imperial 19th century, as the way to provide justification for this war. So not only that this war structurally is the war of the disintegration of the empire, something that we had seen all over the world, but also rhetorically, in the way how it is explained, it is very much an imperial war.
Mm. In your extensive research on the history of Ukraine and Russia, you've examined the complex interplay between Russia's imperial aspirations and Ukraine's quest for self-determination. Can you share specific examples or maybe turning points in history that exemplify this ongoing battle for dominance?
One very, very clear example is, of course, comes from the 19th century, with the Russian Empire banning publications on the Ukrainian language, in Ukrainian language.
The Valuev
circular then was followed by the Ems, another Ems edict. Ems edict was signed by the Russian Emperor Alexander II, which banned publication or import work in Ukrainian language for more than 40 years. So the most important, in many ways, stage in the nation building, in the formulation of the national project, culturally, politically, and otherwise. And what the empire was trying to do, it was trying to kill the modern national project in its really infancy, at the period when it was just created, when it was trying to acquire its wins, again, cultural wins, political wins, social wins, and so on and so forth. This is the example of, first of all, fighting the Ukrainian national movement, on the other hand, really not admitting the existence of Ukrainians as a separate nation. So that's the echo that you see today in the Russian rhetoric, in Putin's articles, in Putin's pronouncements. What then happens when the Bolshevik Revolution comes to the fore, when this major transformations are taking place. The Soviet Union is being created as a union, as a pseudo-federalist state, as opposed to centralized Russian state, trying to deal with two nationalities and national movements. The first one was Ukrainian, the second one was Georgian. So it's the Georgian and Ukrainian communists who rebelled against Stalin's model of the creation of so-called autonomization of the Russian Federation. And Lenin got in and decided to make concessions to the nationalities. Those two nationalities were Ukrainians and the Georgians. With Ukrainians, it was also a major victory in a way that the Bolsheviks recognized them as a separate nationality. They didn't recognize them as a separate nationality before that. But these concessions of the 1920s were replaced with the wave of, first of all, Russocentrism that comes in the 1930s, and then Russification of the 60s and 70s and 80s, which led to the situation in which the largest cities in Ukraine became Russophone cities, and good part of the population was speaking Russian. So to a degree, at the time of the when Soviet Union was approaching its end, the model of the Russification of Ukrainians, and in that way, continuation of the policies that were introduced with the Valuyev circular, they almost reached their goal. But came major crisis of the late 80s, political crisis, the disintegration of the Soviet Union, and that project failed. But again, I keep going to history, returning to history, because what we witness today is very much either continuation of the trends that started almost 200 years ago, or the interruption of those trends as the result of Ukrainian resilience and Ukrainian ability to defend their state, defend their identity in the current war.
Yeah. The development of Russia's national identity over the centuries has been shaped by both real and mythical factors. Can you explain the intangible aspects of this identity and how they have contributed to Russia's imperial ambitions, especially in relation to its interactions with Ukraine?
Well, one thing that you can say about the Russian identity is that it experienced enormous difficulties in the articulation as itself as a modern national identity. And those difficulties were closely linked and associated with the empire, except that for Russians, empire was creating a different type of problems and hurdles and issues and challenges than for non-dominant groups and nationalities. And they talked about them, and those would be Ukrainians and Balts and the North Caucasus and so on and so forth. For the Russians, the issue was that their identity was formed very much in the late 18th and early 19th century as a national project in close association with the empire. So for Russians and for Russian thinkers, it was really very difficult to imagine Russia as being something separate from the empire. From that point of view, the revolution of 1917 was very important, not only in giving chance and providing an opportunity for non-Russian nations to establish their statehood. And in case of Poland and Finland, those statehood as an independent statehood actually continued. But also was important from the Russian perspective that for the first time, with the creation of the Soviet Union, we see that the borders of Russia, in that case, Russian Federation, didn't coincide with the borders of imperial or post-imperial state that Russia kept to control. So for the first time, the Russian Federation acquired its own borders, acquired its own institutions like Ukraine, like later Kazakhstan, and so on and so forth. And that was really a historically extremely important development for the Russians. They never had that before. And some form of identity that was Russian but not imperial started to develop. But it was, by the time of 1991, it was significantly still underdeveloped. Russian quite often meant Soviet. Soviet meant Russian. And not only in the eyes of the reporters, politicians, the general public in the West, but also in mind of Russians themselves. Probably not in the mind of Georgians, not in the mind of many Ukrainians, but certainly in the mind of Russians. And this confluence of empire and nation and rise of really Russian imperial nationalism, that what sets Russia apart from other non-dominant nations of former empire.
And for like in the current form and the way Russia exists, what I argue in my own work is that there is a kind of constant crisis of identity in a way. And Russia, can it even exist without this kind of imperial identity? Because this imperial identity by default requires conquest. So hence, without conquest, there is this logical chain which is somewhat distracted. There is this identity crisis which is constantly there. And the sole and only identity is the imperial identity, which by default requires conquest. So in the current form, that the Russia that we know now is by default designed for this conquest and imperial identity, isn't it?
Conquest, or maybe Reconquista, I would say, really became an important part of Russian state ideology, at least. I think about it existing on two levels. The one level is that post-imperial tendency of bring together under some form of control the former imperial or Soviet space. So all Soviet republics, even the fact that the Balts are today part of the NATO and European Union, I don't think that it affected very much traditional thinking in Moscow that this is still a Russian sphere of influence. And that would be true for all non-Slavic republics. So the desire to continue with some form of not just presence, but with some form of dominance, the creation of the so-called Eurasian Union is a manifestation of that. And then there is an inner circle, and this is reimagining of what Russia is or was in comparison to the Soviet experience. For the new government, it's very uncomfortable to live within the borders of the Russian Federation created by Lenin. That's why Putin attacks Lenin all the time, because that was, from their perspective, was a performer. That didn't mean much. Now, they are prepared to adjust to the new near-imperial world in which Russia would be present in certain areas of the former Soviet Union, but not carry the burden of the traditional empire. Neocolonialism is a cheaper form of controlling the space and resources and so on and so forth. But they believe that the East Slavic core of the Soviet Union, it is Russian and belongs to Russia. From that point of view, you see annexation of the Crimea, you see formal attempts to annex parts of Ukraine and generally cancel not just Ukrainian identity, but Ukrainian statehood as a whole. Attempts of integration of Belarus. So the readiness to extend the Russian borders at the expense of the other East Slavic neighbors, something that you don't see in case of non-Slavic republics of the Soviet Union. So it's basically a return to the imperial understanding of what Russia is, which includes Russians, Ukrainians, and Belarusians, and then post-imperial attempts to control non-Slavic space. So it's imperial vision of nation and post-imperial vision of the Soviets, of the former Soviet space.
Yeah, given that you mentioned that issue, many of our listeners have heard a lot from people like Kirill Hovorun and Jose Casanova and others, and how sociological, theological discourse around this kind of macro-sociological categories or ideologies are formed. I wonder if you can provide us with your thoughts and your take about the idea of Russian world, and what does it, how does it relate to the idea of Kiev and Rus? Because many times in the debates, we see this fusion of these concepts, which mean totally different and are instrumentalized in the Kremlin's discourse. Would you guide us through slightly, well, kind of off the topic of your book, but what does exactly Russian world mean? And does it have a kind of historical validity?
Like many tropes of the current Russian propaganda, the term Ruskiy Mir itself comes from the 19th century. It comes from the idea still of the one big Russian nation, including Great Russians, Little Russians, the language of that time, and White Russians or Belarusians. And it was very much formulated also in response to what was considered to be a Polish and Catholic threat, right? So it's very much part of attempt to do something to integrate the partitioned territories of the former Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the conditions where not just religion, but also ethnicity, народность, самодержавие, православие, народность, when народность also becomes a major factor, and the instrumental beauty, for the lack of a better word, of the Ruskiy Mir comes with the fact that you can actually can define and redefine it. The borders are quite fluid, and they can be defined in a different way depending on the circumstances. It can be the ethnic component, which would include Eastern Slavs. It can be a linguistic component that would put emphasis on the Russian language, and then you can go beyond the East Slavic territories. You can go into the Baltics. You can go into Germany, where the post-Soviet emigres live. And then extremely important component is certainly religion and orthodoxy in particular. Most of this components from language to culture to ethnicity to religion in the traditional Russian mythology, they go back to Kiev. It started already in the 17th century, partially with the help of the Orthodox clergy from Kiev and Kiev's monastery. They're now right at the center of many controversies, continue to be. Kiev was envisioned not only as the birthplace of the Russian monarchy, dynasty, state, but also of the Russian religion and Russian nationality or ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of the birthplace of the Russian state and Russian dynasty is already there in the 15th century when Moscow tries to take control over Novgorod. And the argument for why they have to run Novgorod is that they come from Kiev.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the Kiev card that is being played already in conquest of Novgorod. What the Kiev's monastery monks do in the 17th century, they add the nationality component. So the beginning of this idea of the big Russian nation, the Russians at that time, Moscovites, don't think yet in national categories. They think in categories of dynasty, the category of the religion, but not the category of nationality. And Then it becomes extremely important in the 19th century when Kiev becomes really the center of the struggle against the West, the Catholicism, the Polonization. For purifications, Slavic and Orthodox purification of the land. The land is populated very much as it's a shtetl land. There is a huge Jewish population apart from Polish and other. And in Kiev, they create the university, they build a monument to Saint Volodymyr, they build a monument to Khmelnytsky as a unifier, alleged unifier of Russia and Ukraine. All of these monuments that you see now coming from the 19th century in the downtown Kiev, they had to be, rethought by now and repurposed. But the original idea, that's the Western forepost of the empire, which is in the process of nationalization, reimagining itself not just as Romanov Empire, but as Russian ethnically, religiously Russian Empire. And Kiev becomes, again, the battleground for that. The rise of the Russian nationalism in the Russian Empire at the beginning of the 20th century, again, comes from the very same territories. The largest union the department of the Union of the Russian People, this Russian nationalist organization, comes from Volhynia, right? That's where the dividing line is between the Orthodoxy and Catholicism, between the East Slavs and the Poles, and so on and so forth. So Kiev symbolically has been a very important part of Russian identity since late 15th century, in many ways, from dynasty to religion to nationality. And then you end up after 1991 in a situation where Kiev, which is allegedly the birthplace of Russia, happens to be the capital of the neighboring state. And you play all sorts of games. You build a monument to Saint Vladimir in the capital of Moscow. You start war. You try to liberate the true Russians from the nationalists and so on and so forth. And A big part of that story is really inability to deal in a critical way with the mythology that has not just decades but centuries of history behind it.
Yeah, well, it brings me to my next question. Throughout your research on historical relationships between Russia and Ukraine, you have likely encountered various misconceptions or overlooked aspects of their complex dynamic. Can you discuss some of these misconceptions and explain why it is essential to challenge them in order to understand or to better understand the historical context and present day implications?
I would talk about ingrained mythologies that are based on those misperceptions. And very often misuse and abuse of history, quite conscious that had been undertaken for very practical reasons. And the most maybe one that comes to my mind at this point is closely linked to the justification for the current war. When Vladimir Putin goes there and says that Ukraine really doesn't have the right to exist because it's part of Russia, but also because it was created by the Bolsheviks. So it's a different way of delegitimizing the project, not only in imperial terms that, okay, it was part of the Russian Empire, it was part of Russia, it was gift to whoever, to the Ukrainian Republic. Then the other argument is this, that it is a Bolshevik creation. And that's a classic example of getting on purpose everything wrong, starting with chronology, right? So that is denial of the existence of the and effectiveness of the Ukrainian project before 1917. That's a denial of the fact that Ukrainian statehood was created in 1917 by Central Rada, and the declaration of the creation of the state came as a response to the October coup, October revolution of 1917, not as a result of that. That is a denying of the fact that the first war that Lenin's Russia starts in January of 1918 was the war on Ukraine and takeover of Kyiv in January of 1917. And that's the beginning of the huge violence of the so-called civil war and revolutionary wars. So all of these things that I just mentioned are completely removed, forgotten, and dismissed. And then to the fore comes the year 1922, when Lenin comes out of nowhere and allegedly creates like a god on the sixth or third day of the creation, creates those nations. And again, it's that sort of misuse of history is not something particularly new. That was really the critique of Bolsheviks, of Lenin, of Trotsky, by the white generals like Denikin and others, by the Russian emigres during the interwar period. So that's just one of those examples. Again, not dealing. I dealt already enough with Kiev and Rus and with early modern period. This is example that comes from the 20th century. Had been presented recently in the context of the justification of the war, and like other getting history wrong lines has already some prehistory, and because of that has also some traction, because it's not for the first time that people hear that sort of historical exercises.
Yeah, I know historians as well as maybe sociologists, we don't like to examine the process as it goes, and definitely one of the outcomes that we need an outcome to analyze in a way, right? So and maybe the next question will not be so much scholarly, it's more like intuitive in a sense. How did the war changed Ukrainian national identity, and in what directions so far as of our episode is going to be released in May? So as of now, what's your scholarly hunch feeling? To what direction the Ukrainian national identity is going?
Well, for answering this question, like answering almost every other question about the war, it's extremely important to either understand or remind ourselves that the war didn't start in 2022. The war started in 2014 with the Russian annexation of the Crimea, the start of the war in eastern Ukraine, in Donbass area. And I'm saying that not just for the sake of saying that, okay, let's keep chronology right, but because that chronology is very important for understanding of what has been happening with the Ukrainian self-identification, nation, sense of unity, attachment to the state. The 2014 actually jump-started many of these processes that really transformed Ukraine dramatically between 2014 and 2022 into a much more unified state, the state that was much more conscious of its own identity, much closer society got to the state and state discovered support in the society. And in that sense, what came as a surprise in 2022 that Ukraine resisted and resisted so effectively was the outcome of the previous 8 years of the war, or more importantly, the impact that it had on the Ukrainian society. And then these processes that I just mentioned in terms of more cohesion within the state, much more value put on the Ukrainian identity, more value on Ukrainian culture, rediscovering a state as an instrument of the society, that came to the fore, and really there was further very significant progress in all these directions in the course of the 2022. But none of them started in February of 2022. The major trigger was 2014, and I recently reviewed for Washington Post a very, very good book by Olga Onuk and Henry Hale, The Zelensky Effect, where their argument is that Zelensky phenomenon is basically top of the iceberg. It's manifestation of this new sense of the civic identity that developed in Ukraine. And it is in the book, but I really, really stress that in my review that 2014 is really a very important point in terms of the transformation of the society, but also in the transformation of now the main spokesperson for that society, Volodymyr Zelensky, who before 2014 really was not taking any political position whatsoever, who was better known in Russia than he was known in Ukraine. And it is in 2014 that actually his jokes also go political, and it's the issue of the Crimea, it's the issue of war, it's the issue of Russia. So, but again, to a degree that Zelensky's stand in 2022 reflected the stand and the state of mind of the Ukrainian society, to the same degree, his start of his change in 2014 reflects the start of the changes in the Ukrainian society.
As we're reaching the end of our interview, I have two more questions to before we finish. Considering the deep historical roots of the struggle between Russia's imperial ambition and Ukraine's national identity, what do you think external actors such as the European Union or United States can or should play in navigating this complex relationships and promoting stability in the region?
Well, most of us of our interview was about history and identity. And I will start answering this latest question also looking at that from the same perspective. The collective West, Europe in particular, but United States as well, are extremely important for the formulation of the Ukrainian national identity in the course of the 19th and 20th century. That was the other pole, the counter pole, so to speak, to the Russian Empire, to the Moscow, as a political, cultural, and so on and so forth institution. That was a beacon on which Ukrainian national project was orienting itself. You start with Kostomarov's first formulation of the modern national project in the 1840s. It's already envisioning some kind of a Slavic federation, which also includes Western Slavs. You look then at Drahomanov in the 19th century. It's a European Mazzini type of federation with inclusion of Europe. You look at the national communists, at people like Mykola Khmelnytskyi, and their argument is we should orient ourselves on cultural Europe and Paris and so on and so forth. And in that sense, sometimes before I heard this question, okay, what do Ukrainians think they're doing? Don't they understand in what deep trouble the European Union is? What sort of issues are there? There is no unity and so on and so forth. And my answer was back then and continues to be today, yeah, what actually happens in real life is important, but it's really overshadowed by this importance, historical and cultural importance of Western Europe as the way to articulating itself as a nation, as a project, as a culture different from Russian one. And that didn't change. The support that very few expected that would come from the West today, I think, reinforces this this long-term tradition in the Ukrainian thinking. It's not like the relations are unproblematic and so on and so forth, and Ukrainians legitimately ask for more help and more support. But in general, I think that the latest developments really go in that direction. And in terms of Europe or the United States can do more, the most important thing that they can do, they can stay the course. Because most of the questions that people in Ukraine ask today is not how long we can last. This is not like this question people don't ask. But the most probably urgent question is how long the West and Western support can last, right? So that's at the top of the concerns. If the answer is resounding, we'll stay with Ukraine as long as it takes, which was stated by some current leaders. If that continues from one election to another, the West is democracy, right? Which comes with pluses, which comes also with a lot of question marks. So one of the question marks, okay, if that policy would continue, is the new round of elections in the European countries or in the United States? And if the answer is yes, that's the most reassuring answer that the Western allies of Ukraine can give Ukraine.
And the last question will be, as we finish our interview, what are the lessons learned from history that can an informed European learn from this war?
I was shocked even before this war, but especially now, with the level to and degree to which the history of the last 10 years, let's say, rhymes with the history of Europe in the 1930s. From the Great Depression to Great Recession to the rise of populist politicians to the rise of xenophobia and nationalism to the military aggression, annexation of the territories and so on and so forth. The closest parallel that we can find to developments of the last 10 years would be 1930s. And as a historian, I was under one impression, illusion and delusion, that we as a society learn from the past, learn from the mistakes. And what I discovered that there was very little learning done by the societies as a whole from the history of the 1930s. And that's a reminder for us as we move forward that history matters, and that not learning from history is basically maybe one of the most dangerous things that we can do as we move forward.
Fantastic. As we conclude this captivating episode of Religion Praxis, we would like to express our deepest gratitude to Professor Serhii Plokhii for sharing his exceptional expertise and insights into the intricate relationships between history, identity, nationalism, focus on Ukraine-Russia conflict. The historical context and nuanced understanding he has provided will undoubtedly serve as a valuable resource for all those seeking to comprehend the origins and implications of the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine. Thank you for joining us on this enlightening journey, and we look forward to bringing you more engaging conversations with leading experts on the future episodes of Religion and Praxis. Until then, take care and stay curious.